Hello and welcome to another episode of Sniffing the Pages. I am Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And in this special World Book Day episode, we will be discussing three wonderful books. The Migration by Helen Marshall is a beautiful and lyrical yet dark speculative debut work of fiction about sisterhood, transformation and the limits of love. Secondly, set between the magical realism of a fantasy dinner party and the events leading up to it, The Dinner List by Rebecca Searle is a bittersweet story of finding oneself and love in the modern world and holding on to what matters and learning to let go. Finally, Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is a fast-paced novel set in the late 70s and follows the lives of seven members of a rock and roll band. It's a novel packed full of sexual tension, missed opportunities, and fighting for what you believe in. Firstly, before we begin, I was sent an early edition of The Guilty Party by Mel McGrath. The Guilty Party follows the lives of four friends following the aftermath of an incident all of them witnessed but did nothing about. Later on, as a body is washed up on the banks of the Thames, each of them begin to question why they did nothing to step in. Mel McGrath is the author of the best-selling psychological thriller Give Me the Child and is an award-winning writer of fiction and non-fiction. The Guilty Party is available now in hardback, ebook, and audio download. So first, The Migration by Helen Marshall.
So the back of the book says, storms and flooding are worsening around the world and a mysterious immune disorder has begun to afflict the young. Sophie Perella is about to begin her senior year of high school in Toronto when her little sister Kira is diagnosed. Their parents' marriage falters under the strain and Sophie's mother takes the girls to Oxford, England to live with their Aunt Irene, a Oxford University professor and historical epidemiologist obsessed with relics of the Black Death. Irene works with a centre that specialises in treating people with the illness. She is a friend to Sophie and offers a window into a strange and ancient history of human plague and recovery. Sophie just wants to understand what's happening now. But as mortality rates climb and reports emerge of bodily tremors in the deceased, it becomes clear that there is nothing normal about this condition and that the dead aren't staying dead. When Kira succumbs, Sophie faces an unimaginable choice. Let go of the sister she knows or take action to embrace something terrifying and new. So that's quite a good summary, actually. I really like this.
I liked it.
It's eerie.
Uncomfortable way.
Yeah.
I suppose it's good because if a book makes you feel that way, it's pretty vivid
writing. I think it's because it takes you up against the limit of what is normal or what is okay, and it's quite challenging in that sense. So it gives you kind of that sense of, yeah, what might happen. And it's partly because it's fantasy, or not fantasy, but sort of post-apocalyptic fantasy grounded in reality.
Yeah.
So what's happening is that storms are worsening, you know, climate change is reaching a sort of critical point. And that's so relatable for us these days that the book takes on a much more terrifying or, you know, scary, eerie feeling to you, because there's a part of you that sees how it's not that far away from reality. I think when you read like a fantasy novel and it's things happen that are terrifying, but you're like, right, well, that's clearly a fictional world, I can put that away from myself, but this feels so rooted in reality. But then it flies off into this sort of sense of the fantastic.
Literally.
And the scary, but yeah, it makes it much more chilling.
Yeah. So the two characters, Sophie and Kira, they moved to Oxford from Toronto, and I think I like that aspect. I know obviously that area because I'm from the Midlands originally, so that was quite sort of relatable there. And the youngest character, Sophie, suffers from this ever-evolving strange condition that they're labelling, and I've got it written down here.
Okay, good.
Juvenile idiopathic immune deficiency syndrome.
Yeah, so then they call it JI too, and that's what I suggest they call it too.
Because
I can't bother to keep remembering. Juvenile idiopathic immune disorder, whatever you said.
Yeah. And these stories are popping up on the internet of the people that have died and the children, and so
I think,
it's kind of there,
it
isn't
it,
in their face.
Quite real to me, like I could imagine it actually happening. That's what's quite scary. But I think the strength of it for me is that the characters, they're written so well. Her relationship with her sister and that bond is written with such strength and emotion.
I really liked that opening line in the opening chapter, which says Sophie's saying she didn't know what dead meant. She thought it was a stillness, a long vacation, a going away.
Yeah.
And I thought that's exactly how you feel when you're a child. You don't understand the concept and the reality of death as this.
Yeah.
This thing.
And in a lot of ways, I think that's what it is. It's about growing up in some senses. This is Sophie transitioning from being a child to having to face up to really adult problems because the world is falling apart around her. But that's effectively still what's happening. She's having to make adult choices for the first time, difficult, hard choices.
And she doesn't have anybody around her, really. Her dad, they don't say, I mean, obviously there's some sort of relationship issue. The dad doesn't come with them to Oxford from Toronto. He stays there. And the mum is kind of off in her own little world, grieving and for the relationship and later on for her youngest daughter. So it's really just down to Sophie to crack on with it, really, isn't it? I mean, she's got the relationship with her aunt.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting one because it's almost like a sort of half friendship, half aunt, niece, half, you know, the roles aren't really clearly defined, and get the impression her aunt's someone who's more comfortable in academia than necessarily relating to people.
Yeah.
So there's that sense of her, I don't know, struggling to try and provide what she thinks Sophie needs, but not necessarily being able to give it.
Because she hasn't got her own kids, has she? But
yeah. But no, I think it's like that kind of book that raises questions. I mean, I've read other books as well. So one of the quotes on the back is by is from M. R. Carey, who wrote The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yes.
Which is written. Have you read that?
I've read that. Yeah.
Super creepy. Even more so, actually.
It's a film, isn't it? As well.
It is a film now. Yeah, I haven't seen the film. But that book really freaked me out to the point where halfway through I was like, I can't believe I'm reading this.
Mm.
I'm so scared and I can't put it down. But this had that same sense to me, which is that the reason it's scary is because it makes you question what you would do in those circumstances. And you want to think that you do what on paper looks like the right thing.
Mm.
But it does make you question yourself and humanity's ability to make good choices.
Yeah.
Under those extreme circumstances.
And she makes a couple of random choices. So when Sophie busts her sister out of the morgue. Because obviously it happens quite early on in the novel. The sister passes away.
The point of the book is that people die from this, or caused by or in some way linked to this JI2 disorder that they've got, and that quite early on it becomes clear that they're not. Or that something is happening after death. It's not clear what's happening. And so Sophie decides.
They're calling it the Lazarus effect.
Yeah.
So the body starts shuddering after. And they see these images online, don't they, of these things happening to young people that have just passed away.
And so the policy is to cremate the bodies always. And Sophie wants to, I guess, part of it's maybe a grief reaction that she doesn't want to believe her sister's gone. So she chooses to believe this means that there's something of her sister still left inside there. And as a result of that, she takes the chance to try and break her out of the morgue. It is quite
dramatic, that bit.
Yeah, and it's quite dark in a way because she's literally stealing her sister's dead body, and then she's got to go and hide it somewhere and see what happens. And you say she's got no support with this. She's not doing this.
And she gets herself into quite a bit of trouble. Physically injures herself quite a lot during that process of getting her there, doesn't she?
In fact, throughout the book, she physically injures herself quite a lot.
Yeah. But, I think that was the part that really sat with me and made me feel quite unsettled, was the notion that the sister was in this cement, where was it?
Abandoned cement works or something.
Yeah, and she was just there, and there was parts of the novel where the author didn't go back and give me enough information, and I was thinking, is the sister all right?
She's still there? What's happening?
No, you need to go and check on her because it's been a day or 2 days or.
And it's creepy because you don't understand what's happening, and that's because in the book they don't understand what's happening either. So what's happening to these people after death, and it's not clear, and there's that. That is a creepy concept. Like, you want to believe people die, then they're gone. Not that people with this condition then. Something happens to them, there's some kind of transformation or whatever it is, they like this Lazarus effect they're talking about.
And there's an actual part in the book where Sophie talks about somebody saying something about somebody that had died or a pet or something, I can't remember what it was now, and she didn't like the thought, and that was what disturbed her the most about this person or animal or something going to heaven. She hated that. It didn't sit with her at all well. She hated that more than the concept of
that them just being gone. Yeah, just being I remember that sticking with me as well, that it she wanted it to be. But I think that's...
She didn't like the idea of this eternity of just hanging around.
Yeah, she wanted there to be a clear answer. And I think that's, to me, how she sort of starts out, is she's quite scientifically minded. Like, she's looking for a rational explanation. She wants there to be a solution or an answer. She wants to understand, really. That's what she's trying to do. That's what she's pushing for. And I guess, yeah, as she goes on, she's afraid. It's a scary, it's very thought-provoking. It does make me think, a lot about, yeah.
And how did you like the style of the writing? Because I found every chapter she would begin with a real description of the where it was, what the sky looked like, what the sounds, what everything smelt like, you know, all that kind of, there's a real sense of place that you got within the novel because of the descriptive writing I found.
Yeah, it was beautifully written. I felt sort of fell inside it, if that makes sense. So, you know, yeah, I think that's the descriptive nature.
A lot of these sort of pink skies and...
Yeah, kind of it was really evocative. I felt really immersed in it. And I say the character building is really strong. Like, I loved Sophie. I was really rooting for her.
Yeah.
Even when it was, you know, she's making weird decisions.
Yeah. And a bit later on, it gets even more eerie when these bodies start evolving into these nymphs, and the sound of that in the sky, and you can hear them.
Yeah, you can almost hear it.
The sound
rustling of
those wings, sort of pounding through the air, and that again, that just really sent shivers down my spine, and just this idea of them hearing them before they could see them.
Yeah, it's a challenging concept, isn't it? It's like a necessary evolution. To sort of, yeah, to you're evolving. They're evolving to deal with the way that the planet is going. You know, the climate change is taking us, but it's taken to an extreme. But it is it's an important question, because, you know, climate change is a real, genuine issue. I'm not saying it's going to lead in that direction, but it does make you want stop. It did make me anyway stop and think.
And one thing I thought was really interesting was the way that she wrote geographically, because I'm from that particular area in Oxford and Warwickshire and all around there, and she mentions Warwickshire, and I just like the way that she talked about heading to Bournemouth or Dorset, I think she put, and I just really picked up on that. I thought, you know, they're obviously the same thing, aren't they, Bournemouth and Dorset?
Well, one
Bournemouth
is in the other, yeah.
And I think the other one she said was head north to Warwickshire, you know, from Oxford. You know, it's not America, which is huge, and that's
the kind of
thing you'd say
north.
If in America, wouldn't you just drive head north? And
I don't know, my geography's questionable.
Literally, Warwickshire.
North of Warwickshire. I would not know.
Literally, just like, oh, we're there. Oh. I just found that really interesting.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. That's almost like a phrase that you'd.
Yeah.
Head north is a big sort of.
It is. Yeah.
Suggests to me, head north is like, let's go to Scotland.
Yeah.
Or, you know, but let's go to Newcastle.
England is so much
Thinking
smaller than America.
Really far north, no.
Not a fault in her writing. I just found that quite fascinating. From a geographical perspective.
Yeah, because it's relatable to where we are.
The other eerie sort of thing that sat with me was the way that Sophie starts to feel that something's calling her, isn't she? She can sense it and feel it, like that pull towards that need to be where her sister is. And
yeah, and you know, it's how much of that is caused by the condition that she's developed, and how much of that is her bond or her relationship with her sister. It did make me, yeah, I loved their relationship and that kind of, the idea that even though her sister's changed or gone or whatever it is, it's hard to be clear in the book, but that there's still, she's still there, she's still inside there, and that she still remembers her sister, and that they can connect, and so there's some kind of connection between them, which is quite a lovely thought, really.
And it had an ending that was what will happen next kind of ending. It wasn't a definitive the end.
No, it wasn't sort of a, yeah,
it left you wondering
ending. It was, there was,
what's going to happen?
Yeah, room to interpret, I suppose. And I guess you get to decide how you feel about that ending. I walked away from the whole book feeling quite more positive than I expected to.
Yeah.
Given how dark and difficult some of the sort of subject matter was.
So you feel I felt quite uncomfortable, and I use that word eerie, but yeah, it just made me feel quite unsettled for most of it. But again, like I said, I think that's good writing. If
Absolutely,
it makes you feel in any way.
It stays with you, doesn't it? It stays with you.
From feeling normal. So, but yeah.
Yeah, I think probably the worst thing that you could come away from a book feeling is absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Completely indifferent. Like, as a writer, you must want people to feel something in regards to your work.
Mm.
Probably almost rather people hate it than people feel meh about it.
Do you want to do stars?
I think I gave it 4.
Mm.
That's what I felt like I gave it.
Yeah, mine was a 3.5, but actually now that I've spoken about it, I feel it's more of a 4.
This keeps happening to me. The more we talk about it, I talk my reviews up. I talk my star ratings up. Yeah, I really liked it. It was a solid 4 for me, definitely.
Yeah. Good. So the second book we read was The Dinner List by Rebecca Searle. What if your dream dinner party were to actually happen? For New Yorker Sabrina, fantasy becomes reality when she arrives at her 30th birthday celebration to find not only her best friend but also her long-dead father, her admired philosophy professor and the love of her life, and silver screen icon Audrey Hepburn. Unbelievably though, this seems at first as the wine and conversation start to flow, it becomes clear that these individuals have each played a crucial role in the course Sabrina's life has taken, and that they have come together at this moment in time for a reason. Follow Sabrina over one evening and 10 years as she grapples with the definition of romance, the expectations of love, and how to navigate her way to happiness in this bittersweet romance for our times. I say definitely bittersweet is one word to describe the novel overall.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked it, saying that about all of them. But I did, so that's good.
Was it how you thought it was going to be?
No, it wasn't. I don't know what I thought it was going to be, because obviously that's that concept of your fantasy dinner party becoming reality. It's sort of a fantastical notion, so there's a bit of you that's... I didn't know how it was going to be.
I think
it
part
wasn't
of me...
what I thought, and it made me feel... I maybe thought it was going to be a lighter, sort of sillier read
than it
was.
Yeah, I think I did.
And I don't... You know, this. I don't mean that as a criticism of either what it was or what it wasn't, but just that I think I anticipated it being, a bit more lighter and a bit more lighthearted. Mm. And actually it was quite, bittersweet and affecting and emotional in places.
Yeah, I think it was, I thought it would be more based around the dinner party.
Yeah, like
and
what
it was
would
just
actually going to
be all these conversations and what was going to, and then, there was, it was half that and half not that, wasn't it? So...
I think what happens is that half, in the dinner party happens for Sabrina in this situation because it's helping her come to terms with something or process something that's happening in her life. So I guess that's why it's less about the dinner party and more about her actual life and what's happening and why she actually needs the dinner party at that moment in time, what she needs help to move on from or deal with.
And did you guess the reason at any point?
No,
I didn't either.
I didn't, and it was quite I gasped.
Yeah.
Gasped aloud, so it definitely surprised me. That's not where I thought it was going. And it did make me cry, the book. Not that particular bit necessarily, but just the whole book in general, the way it handled her relationship with her dad, her relationship with their friendship and the love of her life and what happened with them, so I really liked it, and it's interesting. It made me think loads about, so you want to read it and then you immediately want to ask, what would your fantasy dinner party list be,
which we'll get to in a moment,
but it made me think about that question, because the answer is sort of really dependent on what do you want to get out of the dinner party. So your fantasy dinner party list for just want to go and have a really fun evening is different to your fancy dinner party list for want to help me cope with personal trauma.
Yeah.
Or want to help me,
become more intellectual.
Yeah, because I want to know the answer to a certain set of questions about history, or I want to understand this particular thing. And I guess, do you pick?
Chuck
and why?
Them all in there.
Yeah,
mix
exactly. Well, that's what's so interesting about this, is I really loved Audrey Hepburn.
I know,
being in
it's just so fantastic that she's just kept cropping up every now and again, just going, oh, hello, yes.
And they're having these chats, about, and some of them, people who have known her, and then it's just like, oh, hi, Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, and she didn't refer to her in this shocking way throughout the novel, because she could have made a real emphasis on the fact that it's Audrey Hepburn, oh my God, she's at my dinner party.
No, she just interacts like everybody else.
There was little bits of, oh, yeah, it's Audrey Hepburn, I keep forgetting, and then she'll just have a little chat with her. And
I love the way it started, though. It was like, Audrey Hepburn is pissed off that I'm late.
Yeah.
I just love it. I really liked that. And I think that really helped the book to add in a character that wasn't related directly to her life, that she obviously admired hugely, and like the film, Audrey Hepburn's films have obviously been kind of important to her in her life, but they haven't.
Yeah, you know, they're referenced Audrey Hepburn quite herself hasn't the book been a quite personal, lot,
personal someone that she's known, so that added a sense of, yeah, lightheartedness and kept it feeling like fantasy, not like an actual dinner party that was happening. Her old philosophy professor had to travel quite a long way. Did he travel, like on a bus?
Mm. Or he left train? First, didn't he?
Or so did he just pop up there? How did he know he had to be there?
Mm.
I appreciate you're not supposed to think too much about the logistics of this, but I was really confused about
it. Yeah, but that's making me think about, now that you're saying that, is about the sort of penultimate scene before the very end when she leaves with the love of her life. I'm not going to spoil it for anybody or anything, but... that little bit, I'm crying, thinking about it. Yeah, can you remember just that last line that he speaks to her and she says, you know, there's only a little bit of time that they've got till the end of the dinner party.
The end of the dinner party. So I think they understand that the dinner party will end at 12 midnight and that's when it will end. They won't.
Yeah.
Those people who aren't, you know, Audrey Hepburn's not staying around forever. She got other places to be.
I'll say the line to you that I mean off
air.
But
yeah, no, I think I know. God, what
I had
about.
To go back and read that three times.
This,
so
I was like,
I just need to cry over that again. I'm gonna go back and read it.
I really liked it.
Yeah, it was so beautifully written and so much poignancy and relatability. And I really found the whole idea of being in your 20s and just trying to figure life out.
Yeah, there was
being
a huge amount of
girl
that.
and that expectancy of turning 30 and you have to have your whole life sussed out by then. It made me think about how I see things on social media, how there seems to be this idea that by the time you're a 30-year-old woman, you know, if you haven't sorted your life out, you're a bit of a failure.
I have not.
and you know, I speak to people all the time and they say, oh, you know, I'm
30 soon, yeah.
30. By the time I'm 30, I want this done and that done. You know, you've got to have
my
house, got to have this.
It's a big watershed moment, isn't it, for people? And I think it's not. That's the thing.
Because then you reach 30 and then you realise,
I still don't know what I'm doing.
Stop that. I like the dynamics between her and her best friend because it reminded me of friendships that I've encountered over the past where, I think, what was her name? Jessica.
Jessica.
So she had an idea of what was expected from Sabrina in a friendship, and Sabrina wasn't delivering in that way, and in the same sense Sabrina had an idea of what she wanted from Jessica, and the two of them just towards the end didn't communicate enough because Jessica's life was taking a separate path with her baby and things change,
you know,
don't they?
I've had that, you know, you have kids and your friendships do change a bit, or your relationships do change because your life changes.
Yeah, because in your 20s, specifically for me, I had endless amounts of units of the day. We used to count our days in units. There's a film, I can't remember what it's called, The Boy, About a Boy.
Oh, yeah,
You've
yeah.
You've seen that film with Hugh Grant, and he counts his days in units. Because he's just unemployed. He makes all his money from that Christmas record, doesn't he? But, so yeah, that was a bit like me in my 20s, just sitting there going, right, what's that? Let's go out and play a game of tennis. That's two units. It's just like that. And then by the time you have kids, you then...
Where did all the units go?
Yeah, I know. All the units are sucked up. And then you try and continue the relationships with all your friends in your head. And you have this idea that you are, and everything's fine. You're still my mate.
Yeah.
But I haven't actually spoken to you for 7 months. And it's actually really difficult. But, you know, the good mates will stick around, won't they?
I think that's the thing, yeah. And, you know, good friends and honest friendships, you can get through those bits and you can come at the end and say, yeah, I'm sorry, I was caught up in that, but I'm out again now, I'm still here. And, you know, it's not that you can't be friends with people that have kids. That's not true at all. You just need to, I think, be honest with each other and work through it. And that was what was nice about that, because you got to see a bit of that friendship and the way that they were working through it, and then both being honest with each other.
Yeah.
And saying, well, I feel this.
Yeah, and seeing it from both perspectives. Because...
Yeah, it really enabled me to see it from both perspectives. And the other one saying, well, this is how I see it. And the other person saying, well, this is how I see it. And actually, the truth's probably somewhere down the middle.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So who's on your fantasy dinner party list?
Okay, so I struggled a bit and I thought maybe I could have someone like Darwin. But then I thought, would I prefer to have somebody who could give me a bit more information? Because obviously his... knowledge would be just very specific to evolution.
And
it might become a bit
boring after a while. But then I thought, definitely Stephen Fry, because he just fascinates me so much. And I absolutely love him. Because I absolutely used to love all the Blackadder films as well, Blackadder programmes when I was a kid. I had a very dry sense of humour from the age of
still
7.
Love them now,
I think Emma Thompson, I just love her. She's just so fantastic, and I'd like to have a good natter with her. When I was in bed last night, I was thinking actually Victoria Wood would also be fantastic.
Oh, Victoria Wood's on my list.
What,
yeah,
is she?
She's on my list.
How strange. We were connected in our sleep. So yeah, somebody like that. I'm sort of adding way too many people to my list here. I thought Leonardo DiCaprio would be a really nice option, because I just love him as an actor. His acting just completely transports me whenever I watch him, and I just think he'd be brilliant. And also, he is a real... He's doing so much for climate change and, you know, the world generally, isn't he? Seems like a pretty decent chap. And then I've put Beyonce.
Beyonce.
Because I thought if it all gets too serious and boring, we could just do some twerking.
Because that is what Beyonce does at a dinner party.
That's my fancy dinner list.
I don't think I got to five. I overthought this wildly. I got trapped in like, what would we want to discuss? And then there was this bit in that book that really stuck with me quite early on, where she says it struck her that when she made the dinner party list, she was just focused on herself. She wasn't thinking about how the other people would get on with each other. And I really hate awkward social situations.
Yeah.
So from that point onwards, all I could think was, oh my God, I don't want my fantasy dinner party to be super awkward. So then I went, thought about it far too much. So yeah, Victoria Wood was on my list because I love her.
Brilliant.
And Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
Who is just amazing and has gone too soon and would like to, just loved her. I'd love to have met her. So related to my social awkwardness, I also put my husband on the list because one of my favourite things about him is that in a social situation, he's got zero awkwardness and there are never any uncomfortable silences when he's around. So that kind of, I know I'd feel more comfortable and enjoy it more if he was there to sort of like
so
make me
romantic.
Feel...
No, you just made me look like a heartless cow. Sorry, Chris, you can come too, but you've got to let Leo sit next to me.
Well, yeah, exactly. This is the thing. I don't really want him there because of, should have thought about that, shouldn't I?
He can sit next to Beyonce. They can do the jazz hands
then.
In the corner.
Chris would love that. He'd love the chance to jam with Beyonce. Then I got stuck a bit after that and was like, I don't...
What about a bit of comedy? Well, you've got Victoria
Wood.
She's the comedian.
Victoria Wood, and then I was thinking of...
Do you think she'd sing the song for you? The Can't do
Let's
it.
Let's do it.
Can't do
oh
it.
My God, I'd love that. I'd love that. So there's a Eleanor of Aquitaine is a queen from the medieval times she was always really fascinates me because she was a character at the time, not a character but a person.
This is a real but dead person
who had a lot of an unusual amount of power for a woman in her time. I just think that makes her a fascinating character. And then Stephen Hawking was my other one.
Yes.
Because he's an incredible, or was an incredible man. And I'd be really interested to, just again, you almost want to go to this dinner party and then to be like, right, all of you, just talk and I will just absorb your knowledge and your wisdom and bring it into me. But what I quite liked about this is that when we're doing them, we're doing fantasy dinner parties and they're all people that we don't know. I liked about that, though, is that she had quite a lot of people on her list that were people that she, from her life. So her best friend was on that list. And actually, then you think, that's sort of what got me thinking about having, like, Gareth, my husband, be there. Or would it be more fun if there was someone that you knew? And would it be easier to interact with these people? Otherwise, I feel like I might be a bit starstruck. Just sat there going, oh, I don't know, what can I say to Victoria Wood? She's amazing. I'm not sure I'd cope with it very well. Again, overthinking.
I know, but that's the point of it, though, isn't it? It's fantasy. You've got to immerse yourself in the fantasy. It's so strange because I actually had an idea about of a programme that would be so fantastic, but I don't know if they'd be able to make it, like, called sort of the dinner list or the fantasy dinner party, where just your normal everyday person from the street
gets to live their fantasy dinner party. That'd be so cool.
You invite these obviously living people you can invite dead people as well, and they could maybe just do like have a cut
hologram.
out a hologram oh cut out thing
And then, do amazing things with CGI these days.
Yeah, imagine that. That would make brilliant telly.
It really would. You'd have to get a lot of very, very busy, famous people in the right place at the right time. It's probably not feasible, but yeah,
no, it isn't. Yeah, but I mean, they'd probably just end up... You'd give them something like 20 people, wouldn't you? And then they'd just pick the
people that
they could get within the budget.
The headless ones.
Yeah.
But yes, anyway, back to the, back magical to the actual book.
Really surrealism. Bit of Audrey Hepburn, who did some work for UNICEF.
Yes.
Which I didn't know. Did you Google that? I meant to get around to Googling it.
I know, I did actually know that already.
I didn't know that.
I did actually know that already. I can't remember why now. But yeah.
Lovely book. I actually recommended it to somebody the other day who said, I need a recommendation for a book, and I said The Dinner List.
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend it to people. It's a really nice, it's nice and short as well, so it's not super...
Make a great film.
It would make a great film. Mm. I would love to see that, although who would they get to play Audrey Hepburn? That's not Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. It's impossible. What do you do?
Well, they just do that weird thing that they do for that advert that's a bit creepy.
Oh, yeah. Like how we're thinking it's a hologram, I'm sure there's a lot of hugely technical graphics generation behind it, and we're just like, CGI. But yeah, no, I definitely would recommend it. It's a lovely little book. I really like it.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I think I gave it
I gave it 5 stars.
I think I gave it 4.5. I'm hedging, but yeah.
Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Daisy is a girl coming of age in LA in the late 60s, sneaking into clubs on the Sunset Strip, sleeping with rock stars and dreaming of singing at the Whiskey a Go-Go. The sex and drugs are thrilling, but it's the rock and roll she loves most. By the time she's 20, her voice is getting noticed and she has the kind of heedless beauty that makes people do crazy things. Also getting noticed are the Six, a band led by the brooding Billy Dunn. On the eve of their first tour, his girlfriend Camilla finds out she's pregnant, and with the pressure of impending fatherhood and fame, Billy goes a little wild on the road. Daisy and Billy cross paths when a producer realises that the key to supercharged success is to put the two together. What happens next will become the stuff of legend. It says on the back, I didn't realise this, but it says Taylor Jenkins Reid is the author of 6 novels.
Mm.
And this has made me want to go and read more of them.
Yeah. The one is something about
The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo.
Yeah.
Evelyn Hugo.
I've seen that one around, but I never got around to picking it up. You know when you just see a book a lot and then you never,
yeah, never do get around to reading it. Absolutely, there's lots of books out there.
But, this table's really creaky today. Bloody fantastic book.
It is, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Oh, I say, you've got a very sparkly top on.
Yeah, sorry, I'm really...
Katie's just removed her jumper.
Just robing over here.
She's wearing a very sparkly, glitzy top that is quite appropriate for us talking, discussing...
It's my rock star
very
top.
Very glitzy rock star book.
It's my rock star top. Yeah, no, do you know what? I took it home. This is the first one I read of the 5 books I've read for this podcast, and this was the first one I took it home... when we finished recording last time and started reading it that night. And I opened it up, and the way it's structured is it's written like it's a documentary. So it's you get the name of the person and they speak about what happened, and obviously it's lots of them speaking about the same thing and they're coming at it from different perspectives. And when I first opened it, I looked at it and thought, this is going to be quite hard work to read, because often books that don't flow in sort of straightforward prose are a bit more effort to read. But actually that wasn't true at all. It literally felt like watching a documentary. I felt like I was watching it, not reading it.
Yeah.
I read it so quickly. It was so easy to read.
Yeah. And just gulped it down.
Yeah, exactly. I just inhaled it.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was brilliant.
And I agree what you say about the characters initially. I was like, oh, you know, there's quite a lot of characters here. But actually...
Yeah, am I going to have to work hard to keep track of
who's saying
what?
I kind of then started to recognise the voices, I think.
I think that's the thing, yeah. So at first I was like, oh, am I going to have to really work at looking at... Like, Daisy said this. Billy, this is Billy talking now. This is whatever their names are.
Karen.
Sorry, it was a while ago.
Karen. Graham.
This is Camilla writing. This is exactly all those people. But actually, that's not true, because you say they really quickly developed quite distinctive, clear voices. So it was clear who was talking. Anytime I wasn't sure, I could glance at who it was and understand. But broadly speaking, yeah, they were all. And that's really clever to be able to do that, to give your characters. So from so early on,
so much presence and
yeah,
so much
absolutely
voice.
that they're instantly recognisable, you know, within a paragraph, and often they're only speaking for a paragraph at a time before the next person's sort of talking over them. And it felt, I mean, I think it says somewhere on it that one of the comments that someone had made about it, is it Edith Bowman maybe, said, I forgot they weren't real. And that is true. I genuinely Googled Daisy Jones and the Six to check they aren't actually a real band that I just don't know about because I know nothing about music.
Mm.
Because it seemed so real. And because it was written so authentically, I was almost like, hang on, am I reading an actual non-fiction? But no, it was obviously is entirely made up. Although I think we were saying earlier this. Some people have said it's based on Fleetwood Mac. And I think that's not necessarily, I don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but.
Possibly a mixed bag of many bands from that era, although they do talk about in the book all the characters, not compare themselves to, but you know, they want to be up there with the Rolling Stones and
so it does speak about the Beatles, bands that were around at the time, and it does not speak about Fleetwood Mac.
Tellingly,
you know, you get a sense from the beginning, it's clear from the beginning that it's not, you know, that the band does break up, something does happen, and it's just
but it's that journey to that point, isn't it?
Yeah, everything building towards this moment and what it's gonna be like. There's and a real sense of expectation throughout it.
I've folded down. I never do this with books ever because I think it's so wrong. But it just got to a point where I couldn't keep getting my phone out and typing things out all the time. Yeah, so I just folded down the pages, which is terrible, I know. But there's just so many
books are made to be
bits
experienced.
In it that I just thought, my God, that's so relatable. I just have to reread those bits. And I've actually written like some pages here, and I've got to quickly go back and remember because I can't remember. I've put here the cookie bit, page 56. So if I said that to you, would you know what I was talking about?
The bit where they ate cookies that made them high? That happened at one point, right?
Somebody's got... Oh, that's it. I took... Oh, that was it. They're all high.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah, so we're saying Just One More was written and recorded in one day when somebody sent over a batch of grass baked into cookies. The whole song, written mostly by Billy with my help, seems like it's about wanting to sleep with a girl one time before you hit the road. But it was about how we'd eaten all the grass and just wanted one more cookie.
I love it because it's so sort of... Oh, I don't know. It has this real sense, the whole book, of just abandon, and you really get the feeling of that kind of sex, drugs and rock and roll. Like...
And the next bit is brilliant as well, Warren, because he says, I took three of the cookies myself and I hid one of them for later. And as Billy's writing this song about wanting one more, I thought, shit, he knows I have one more. Just stuff like that. I loved it. I think...
I love Daisy as a character as well. I love her how she just doesn't care what other people think. Like, it was very much, I'm going to wear what I want. I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to do what I want. And I really don't care how that makes anybody else feel. I don't care what anyone else thinks. And in some senses, obviously, that's a really selfish, self-absorbed attitude. But there's also that sense of empowerment in it. Like, there's part of me that would love to be more like that. So I found that very
enjoyable
to read.
But there was parts where I just... Her vulnerability and her fragileness was just so...
That's the other thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's a mask.
It was just so much that I found some bits quite hard to read. And I just wanted to...
You
put
just
my
want
arms around
to
her and stop her from getting out of a pool high and walking on broken glass, you know, it's bits like that, like, oh, you're so,
it is, so
completely
got...
trash that you don't know that you're walking on glass, you know.
And no one's been able to, you know, you don't, but I think it's difficult, isn't it, because it's interesting because she comes across then as this, don't care what anyone else thinks, going to do my own thing and be really empowered, but also it's almost like a cry for help. It's like someone... She doesn't really actually value herself enough to look after herself. She's not looking after herself at all. She's really damaging herself.
But it was
herself,
there, wasn't it? Hinting all the time. You could just, and it was all because she gets married later on, doesn't she? To I can't remember what his name is. It's that Italian guy.
Yeah.
There's a point where she's married to him, and all that time when he's just egging her on to get more high,
so
get more trash, just completely, you know, ruin herself. It's there in the back of her mind all the time, isn't it? She knew that it wasn't the right thing to do, and eventually she comes out of that quite sort of, you know,
destructive
relationship. Yeah. I think the one character that stood out the most for me was Camilla.
Yeah.
I just thought she was so fantastic. She just kind of carried the whole book, didn't she?
She really grounded it, I think, yeah. So it's obviously there's all this kind of sense of, sex, drugs,
messiness
and messy, chaotic, beautiful people doing stupid things and all the kind of sexy glamour of that, but actually she really grounded it. And I really, it was really interesting, her relationship with him, because it's all about trust, isn't it, and how she's choosing to trust him. And the difficulty of a relationship with someone who is famous in that way, and how you make that last, and how you have to just make a decision to trust someone, and to trust that they love you, and to trust that they'll always come back, and to trust that they might make mistakes, but it doesn't mean that that all these other things aren't also true. And that his trust in her is what brings him, her trust in him is what brings him back. You know, so he does go off the rails a bit. It says in the little blurb there that he goes a little bit wild on the road early on, when he finds out he's going to be a dad. And then, yeah, that she was able to forgive him, I thought it was amazing, and how their relationship grew from there.
She was the all-seeing eye. She knew exactly what was happening, and she was not there for much of it. So there's a programme that Chris and I used to watch called Nashville, and it reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah,
the whole musician lifestyle, the struggling musicians, the depression, the drinking, you know, all that kind of thing that comes with being a misunderstood
rock star. Yeah, yeah, it's a lifestyle thing, isn't it? That sort of buys into the kind of, it buys into that image that people have of musicians or artists or rock stars, that they live a certain way, that there's this, hard drinking, tortured artist mentality.
Yeah.
I think definitely comes across in some of them.
Yeah, definitely. And also,
are points at which you just want to be like, oh, come on, get over yourselves.
I think he did pretty well. I was rooting for
him. Yeah, I definitely was. Not even just him, all of them, really. I really liked them. I really liked Karen as a character as well.
Yeah.
She was a really well-drawn character.
And it made you realise that in that era, and specifically in the music industry in those days, it was a man's world.
Yeah, and female keyboardist like her was rare. And
she struggled within her own mind, didn't she, as to how she should portray herself, should she, wear this, should she wear that, which is, interesting.
Yeah, and kind of in contrast to Daisy, who sort of basically took the attitude, I'll wear what I want, and it's men's problem how they choose to view me is their problem.
Yeah.
Although, as you said earlier, she's got her own vulnerabilities and issues, but Karen's way of handling it was to do nothing that made her seem overtly female, so to not dress in ways that were, how you define us, I guess, not dressed in sexy ways, so that she would be taken more seriously as a keyboardist, which is, you say, it's a sort of sign of the times, I suppose, that you'd have to do that.
And the album that they write, and is the one that they take on tour, which is
want to hear that album.
Yeah.
And I really want it to be a real album so I can listen to
it. I know, there's the lyrics at the back, and I'm trying to get a tune in my head and think, oh, how would that go?
Want someone to do that.
Because they were really strong lyrics, weren't they? And I think one of the best bits was when Daisy comes in and to record that first song with Billy, and he sings it, they sing it back and forth to each other, don't they? He sings a bit to her, and it's a song about Camilla, isn't it, about, and his promise to her, buying her that ranch, or that sort of big house,
have this house by the sea,
and Daisy just comes straight in and just sings it back to him as a question, doesn't she?
And
he's totally like, what, she totally susses him out, you don't actually know if you're going to be able to commit to this woman and give her what she needs.
What you're promising is a dream, and that's great, it's great to have that dream, but she sort of questions it back at him to say, well, can you provide that? And that, and in the book, of course, she's saying that adds a whole layer of depth to the song, and actually it does. That kind of adds a question into it, rather than just being a simple promise of a dream to someone you love. It's all becomes about, can you make that dream a reality?
And then there's the obvious theme of the unrequited love throughout with Daisy.
Daisy's relationships
with Billy.
With Billy and the rest of the band, and everyone's relationships, but her relationship with Billy is sort of the crucial one, isn't it? That's the kind of driving force behind the book and behind what happens. And behind the album as well, because they write the album together. It made me want to know more about that kind of music scene at the time and just what it was like. I don't know very much about it. I'm not really a music person.
Yeah, but you felt you were there, I did, didn't you?
Yeah, it felt so real. As I said at the beginning, it definitely felt so real. And I think, yeah, there's obviously this question about who, whether it's based on any particular band, but it's definitely a very vivid portrayal of what it was like at that time.
And just to go back to Camilla, just to talk about her as the strength in a woman, there was a scene where she, right in the beginning, when she's just dating Billy before the kids come along and he goes off on tour and makes the album, and she, all the boys are like, we want burgers. So she says, right, go off to the shops, get burgers, but get bacon and this stuff, and I'll, you know, put some bacon on the burgers, yeah, kind of thing. And then he comes back with the burgers, and then she says, oh, the burgers were off or something.
Yeah, and she, yeah.
And so she ends up making the breakfast that she suggested in the first place, but in a really such a subtle way.
Yeah.
That, well, the guys didn't even realise that they were eating brunch by the end of it. They were like...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I thought there's three sort of major female characters in it. There's Daisy and Karen and Camilla. And they all, you know, they all succeed or thrive in some sense in a man's world in completely different ways.
Mm.
So Daisy's this sort of overt, challenging sexuality, and Karen's is to kind of really play down her gender and just let her ability sort of shine through. And then Camilla's is this kind of quiet, non-confrontational strength that's just going to plough on and get what he wants without sort of doing it in that upfront argumentative way. And it's interesting because it's those different ways that you have to, in a world that is very male dominated, which that music scene was very much so in at the time, and probably still is, to be completely honest, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think more so
what you have to do, what women had to do to survive or to
what
thrive.
They still do,
absolutely. And and the different ways that they had to do that,
it makes you realize we haven't come very far at all, does it?
In some ways, yeah, very much so.
Yeah, Billy's writing a bit about Camilla, but essentially he's writing a lot of them about Daisy, isn't he? And his feelings.
Yeah, and his conflict and his feelings for her and his what he wants to do for Camilla. And he's very open about it, isn't it? Like, everything he feels for Daisy, it was never going to come close to what he promised to Camilla. She was always going to be his.
That's right.
She was always going to be his.
And that was a relief, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was always going to be his end game. And I think that was... And that's what Camilla chose to trust in, isn't it? That I will always be his end game. Mm. I will always be what he's coming back to.
Mm.
I trust that he won't do anything on the way that would jeopardise that.
Mm. Yeah. I gave it 5 stars. I thought it was a fantastic book. Coming of age, relationships, families, drugs and addictions, finding happiness and serenity and all in all, just a really lovely love story.
But just the writing of it as well, just the vividness of it, how real it felt, was astonishing, and very, you know, it takes real skill to be,
I think,
as engaging and involving as that.
That Reese Witherspoon has picked this one up. I've just seen it on her Instagram.
On her,
she's just picked it up for, and it's going to be made into a TV series.
Oh yeah, so they're reading it as their book club. Her book club, but they're going to make a series of it,
Which would be great as a TV series.
Yeah,
wouldn't it?
I will definitely watch.
Yeah.
It also, you almost feel like you're watching it anyway.
Yeah.
It's written so well that I almost felt like I was watching rather than reading.
Yeah.
We'll
brilliant book. Bloody brilliant. So now we reach the next part of the show, which we like to call What Katie Read Next. And this week, Katie has been reading 2 books... She's been a real trooper, and she's read The Last Words of Madeleine Anderson by Helen Kitson. Oh, we had 2 Helens this time. And The Snakes by Sadie Jones. So the floor is yours.
Cool. So The Last Word of Madeleine Anderson. So I'll read the blurb on the back and then chat a little bit about what I thought. So once upon a time, Gabrielle Price wrote and published an extraordinary novel. But 20 years on, her literary star has dimmed, her work of genius is all but forgotten, and no further novels have materialised. She now lives an unremarkable life, middle-aged, living alone in the sleepy village she grew up in and working as a housekeeper for the local vicar. Her lonely existence is dominated by memories of her best friend Madeleine, who died young in tragic and mysterious circumstances. Gabrielle's quiet world is turned upside down when she meets and befriends Simon, young, attractive and a would-be writer, an enthusiastic fan of the astonishing novel that Gabrielle published all those years ago. Charmed and flattered, she recklessly invites him into her home and her heart. But Simon is mysterious and manipulative, and it's not long before he forces Gabrielle to confront the demons in her past. Her obsession begins to destroy her carefully cultivated life, and she comes to feel increasingly threatened by Simon's presence. Who is he? Why did he seek her out? And what does he really want? I thought this was interesting. So I started reading it, and I was reading it quite... I was aware that I had to try and finish it so that I could also read the dinner list and get it done in time. And I think once I slowed down and just sort of settled into the pace of the book, I enjoyed it more. It is quite threatening in places. So this relationship that she has with Simon, he kind of just shows up into her life. And I think the thing I found a bit frustrating about it is that she just lets him. She's really passive about it. So she kind of knows that she can see it's a bad idea. She thinks it all the time. So the book's written from her perspective, and she's repeatedly sort of saying, I knew this was a bad idea, but I was powerless against it. And like, part of me kept thinking, why? Why were you powerless against it? So it was an intriguing bit. It was a bit strange. It's very... a lot about the past and how about things that you do in your past, how they might define you. It's interesting because the book's titled The Last Words of Madeline Anderson, which is the name of her friend who died. And, for the first half of the book, I could barely remember the name of the main character. And I think that's kind of a good sort of summary of how it is, really. She's almost lost herself in the memory of her friend who she lost when she was 20 in a tragic accident. Then, yeah, there's this sort of mystery about who Simon is. I mean, it's really clear from the beginning that he's not just a fan who's popped up. He's definitely got an ulterior motive. And it's that kind of... it kept me guessing what was his motive. And I kept thinking I'd worked out who he was and being wrong.
Mm. And the front cover's got fish on it. Is that irrelevant at all?
Well, her friend died by drowning. Right, so I'm going to guess say. That's the... Mm. That's the sort of... this imagery behind that. And it's beautifully written.
Is it?
It's very evocative and atmospheric, and you do get a sense of this threat and his manipulation being quite clever, and I felt quite uncomfortable with their relationship. I felt quite uncomfortable for a lot of reading it, and as you said, I think we said earlier, you know, if it's making you feel uncomfortable, it's making you feel something.
Yeah.
And that's good writing. So
yeah.
So yeah, good. Solid 3.5, nearly 4 stars. Hard to be clear.
Great.
So this is Sadie Jones, The Snakes. And I'll quickly read that blurb. B and Dan, recently married, rent out their tiny flat to escape London for a few precious months. Driving through France, they visit B's dropout brother Alex at the hotel he runs in Burgundy. Disturbingly, they find him all alone in a ramshackle hotel, deserted apart from the snakes in the attic. When Alex and B's parents make a surprise visit, Dan can't understand why B is so appalled, or why she's never wanted him to know them. Liv and Griff Adamson are charming and rich. They are the richest people he's ever met. Maybe Bee's ashamed of him, or maybe she regrets the secrets she's been keeping. Tragedy strikes suddenly, brutally, and in its aftermath, the family is stripped back to its heart, and then its rotten core, and even Bee, with all her strength and goodness, can't escape. Unflinching in its gaze, The Snakes is a bold and brilliant novel which holds the reader in its tense grip from start to unforgettable finish. So that's the blurb. I don't 100% agree. I started out really enjoying this. It's quite a nice, but enjoyable read. I had two major problems with it that stopped me enjoying it as much as I hoped I would. I didn't really like any of the characters. I didn't really connect with them, and I found them a bit difficult to sort of pin down their motivations. And I think this is the kind of book that I can see lots of people loving it, but it wasn't my favourite. It's difficult to really explain why without spoiling it completely. I know that sounds like a complete cop-out.
It looks like a fantastic book from the cover, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We've got the proof, but the design on the inside. The cover.
It's a real family drama and the secrets people keep and those family relationships and tensions. And they were done really well. And that, you know, those things that you can't understand unless you're inside a family. But there were just bits of it, or there were characters' actions that they took that were just felt inexplicable to me. And I found it a bit harder to...
relate to that.
Yeah, or to justify. I found it hard to get on board with feeling so distanced from understanding what they did.
Mm.
I think the other thing I felt is that it was a bit... maybe it wasn't quite sure what it wanted to be.
Mm.
But I say, I think, you know, I finished it and went to look on Goodreads, and I think it seems to have been quite split between people loving it or people feeling a bit like I do, which is...
a bit displaced.
A bit unsure, and maybe it's just not. And I think that's the thing, is it's hard to, you know, books can't... no book is going to please everybody. No book's going to be everybody's favourite. And there's definitely lots to like about it, but it's not, it wasn't my favourite.
But we've read some fantastic books.
Yeah,
this episode, so
it's maybe in some ways part of the problem. Yeah. I've read so many other brilliant books recently, like in recent weeks I've read books I've been giving 5 stars to, and maybe my standards have just suddenly got a bit higher. But
yeah. So that's it for our bumper episode for World Book Day. All of the books that we've talked about today are out now. And next episode, Katie and I are going to be reading and discussing All We Ever Wanted by Emily Giffin.
The Girl in the Letter by Emily Gunness. Emily's.
I know. And The Strawberry Thief by Joanne Harris. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Sniffing the Pages, and we will see you next time.
Happy World Book Day.
Happy World Book Day. Bye.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.